So the real issue is, how do we achieve non-proliferation? Let's talk about solutions. North Koreans said they would not put their nukes on the table of negotiations. And the Washington Post left this line out. It's kind of interesting. Unless the U.S. postal policy and nuclear threat to the DPRK are definitely terminated. They told me many times when I was there, why would we put our gun down under these circumstances? So how do we move closer to this? Some people like Jimmy Carter are making great statements about the importance of a peace treaty. Because essentially, without a peace treaty and formal relations, you don't even show that the other side has a right to exist.
That's Eric Sorotkin. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Eric Sorotkin on war or peace in Korea. Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. What can one say? They are lightweights fighting in the heavyweight division, while the fate of possibly millions are at risk. Two heads of state trading taunts and insults back and forth, like kids in a schoolyard. Trump declared that talking with North Korea is a waste of time and threatened to totally destroy that country by unleashing fire and fury like the world has never seen. On his trip to Asia, he softened his line a bit by inviting North Korea to come to the table and make a deal. He then reverted to more saber-rattling. The U.S. military has been in South Korea since 1945. There is no peace treaty formally ending the 1950-53 Korean War. Maybe that would be a good place to start. Tensions must be diffused. The alternative is catastrophic war. Our guest today is Eric Sorotkin. He's a human rights lawyer whose peacemaking activities have taken him to North and South Korea. He helped found the New Mexico Human Rights Coalition and the National Lawyers Guild Korean Peace Project. He's the author of Witness. He spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And now, Eric Sorotkin.
When I got involved with Korea back in 2003, I never really understood much about Korea at all. I knew there was a war there. I knew that the U.S. had been involved in dividing Korea. But most of the things I knew about Korea, I got, frankly, from MASH reruns. And the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War, has really become the forgotten peace. When I was first invited to North Korea in 2003, a group of North Korean lawyers invited a group of us to come to North Korea. And I had worked in South Africa. I worked originally with the ANC on a constitution in the early 90s. I was an election observer when Mandela was elected, a very hopeful, exciting time for us all. And I then coordinated international monitoring project of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I came to understand in my own life, in my own legal practice, the power of breaking down us versus them. The power in South Africa, what's called Ubuntu, that said there in the statute, there shall be Ubuntu rather than victimization. And the idea was, we are not just victims and perpetrators, but we'll have Ubuntu. And that was a big premise in avoiding a lot of bloodshed in the transition in South Africa. So I brought that home, I put it into my work, I put it into my lawyering, and in my personal life had a big impact on that. And then 2003 came around, and a friend of mine said, do you want to go on this delegation to North Korea? And my curiosity and my excitement for travel and adventure said, sure. And I started to look into it, and I started to read about it. And then I went on this delegation to Pyongyang and toured down to the demilitarized zone and went around and met government officials and families and children. And I began to think, oh my God, why hasn't this been on my radar? And I came back and I started this Korean Peace Project. And the goal of the Korean Peace Project was peace in Korea. And I actually thought this was going to be easy. I thought that peace in Korea, I said, this is not Israel-Palestine. This is two nations with common language, common history, separated families, reunification ministers in their government, commitments to some form of reunification. And I thought, this is doable. Came back, I started talking, I started sharing things. And before I went back to North Korea a couple times again and presented at some peace conferences there, at a conference in Lima, Peru, on peace and reunification of Korea. But even within my own community, even within my progressive community, I got the same blowback and pushback I was getting from mainstream media. Not quite as much, but no one knew a real dialogue other than demonization for this issue. I talked to Michael Moore once. Michael Moore said, I said, Michael, I just got back from North Korea, and I want to tell you it's more complicated than we're being told. And Michael made a joke. Oh, you mean the country with that drug-running leader, crazy leader who loves porn? And he just made a joke about it. And unfortunately, the dialogue hasn't really been much easier than that with people at times. But suddenly we're getting a groundswell, and we're going to talk about that today. And we're going to talk about why it is that after 60-plus years of a temporary ceasefire, we don't have a peace treaty, we don't have peace in Korea, and why today we're on the brink of nuclear war. So let's talk about Korea. Panmunjom, at the border of Korea, there's these UN buildings. On one side is North Korea, and the other side is South Korea. And I've actually stood in the room there and straddled that border with one foot in one country and one foot in the other country, thinking it was some type of cosmic joke, but no one was laughing. But it is a tragic story in many ways. It's a story of millions of separated families. It's a story with a time clock ticking right now because people are aging and dying without seeing their sisters and their brothers and their grandnieces and their families. It's a tragic story that they were still digging up the bones from the Korean War. We're going to talk about the Korean War today because so many people have either forgotten it or never knew anything or never learned much about it. But they dug up many bones during the Korean Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I don't know how many people heard about the TRC in Korea, but the TRC in Korea did some very important work discovering, getting testimony and discovering more than 1,000 mass graves across South Korea that they were able to excavate several dozen before the government shut them down. Apparently there's truth, and there's too much truth, because what they discovered was that hundreds of thousands of people were executed between 1945 and 1950 at the start of the Korean War by the South Korean government. They were killing anyone suspected of being a communist. And so the history of this conflict, including the U.S. military presence and the history in Korea. How do I approach these things? It's pretty much how I approach anything, and I call it the Atticus Finch effect. You all remember Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, fellow lawyer, Gregory Peck. But the scene from that always had an impact is when he's talking to his young child, and he tells the child, you never really understand a person until you consider something from his point of view, till you climb inside his skin and walk around in it. And isn't that the basis of so much of our peacemaking, is understanding, building that compassion, trying to listen to the other side? And so what do we do when we climb down into the story of Korea? What do we find? Korea was divided by a gentleman named Dean Rusk. Dean Rusk, as you know from the Vietnam War, as Secretary of State and such, Dean Rusk was a lieutenant colonel in 1945, and he was working with another colonel, Charles Bonesteel, and they went to a little room in the basement of the White House, and they drew out a National Geographic map, and they said, where should we divide Korea? They've asked us to come up with a plan. They didn't know anything about Korea. They were not Korean experts. But they sat down with a pencil in the basement of the White House, and they drew a line on the 38th parallel. After that, there's a big debate of who started the Korean War. And we get very hung up on that. I mean, if you say South Korea or the U.S. or the U.N. started the Korean War in some way, you go to prison in South Korea under the National Security Act. You're not allowed to talk about certain things, and we're going to talk about that as to how that has been an obstacle for peace. But in 1950, we had the start of police action time. How many times have we seen this over the years? The ability to skip Congress and jump into a war. And Harry Truman said, this is not a war, it's a police action. And so no declaration of war was made. Bruce Cummings is a great scholar on Korean issues. And he asked the very important question, how did a civil war for reunification become a Cold War battleground and an invasion? He said, imagine if the British drew a line splitting America during the Civil War. The British did. Americans didn't like the imaginary line or agree to British enforcement of the line. But here, it was Koreans invading Korea in a civil war, and we came to call it aggression. And aggression it was. The U.S. shipped over 17 million tons of napalm to the Northeast Asia at that time and dropped millions and millions of pounds of napalm in North Korea. The trauma on all soldiers involved, U.S., North Korean, Chinese, was huge. It was a very gruesome war in many ways, and people were killed, but it was the bombing that was historic at this time. The bombing was not only historic, but it came on the heels of bombing in World War II, when we declared never again would we allow bombing of civilian areas in a lot of ways, as how Dresden and how Frankfurt and London and the kind of bombing, indiscriminate bombing that took place. In fact, Pyongyang, it was a thriving metropolis in North Korea at the time and was bombed quite a bit. And we signed the Geneva Convention a year before we started this war and said people had to be treated humanely, that you could not engage in this civilian-type bombing. And as Cummings writes, Pyongyang looked like Hiroshima after the bomb. And in fact, they bombed in North Korea until the colonel in charge of the bombings wrote back to the State Department and said, we can't keep bombing. There's nothing worthy of a dam standing. And this is the carpet bombing that took place. When you step into the shoes of the North Koreans, you have to recognize that they had a country leveled by the United States bombing. That is essential to understand them. This is a nation I would engage, is engaged in continual PTSD, trauma, and they teach it over and over again to children, to soldiers, to young people. They tell the story of the issues around the Korean War and the devastation. So what is the current role then of the U.S. in the region and in Korea? What do we know about South Korea? Because what is it that makes North Korea a little bit nervous over the years? Well, first of all, I am not an apologist for the North Korean regime. There are serious violations of human rights that take place, and it is a country that is developing nuclear weapons, and I'm a huge advocate of non-proliferation. But the only way to deal with these issues is step in those shoes and understand what are the factors impacting the region. South Korea is a country the size of Indiana, with over 100 bases and posts of the United States, with over 25,000 U.S. troops stationed there and tons of personnel and otherwise associated with the base. For various reasons, there's over 300,000 U.S. citizens living in South Korea in a very small area, and Seoul is very close to the border. What happens every year, twice a year, that just upsets the North Koreans and sends them into a frenzy and probably builds strength and power for the Kim regime on an ongoing basis? They are the military exercises, the war games, if you will. These take place where they use all kinds of troops, all types of weaponry are used. They use nuclear-powered, nuclear-capable submarines. They use planes. They drop parachuters. They include tens of thousands of troops. They simulate landings of more than 200,000 troops to occupy Pyongyang. We've seen that there are documents now showing they have plans to decapitate the leadership in North Korea. Well, there's great things about living in a free society, and we love it, and so consequently, other countries do get a little of our information, and in doing so, they act accordingly. And so these military exercises have created an ongoing problem. Another issue that the North Koreans watch, and frankly a lot of the world watches, is the largest naval base in the world is being constructed on Jeju Island in southern South Korea. It is a beautiful place, Jeju Island. It is a heritage site. It has these amazing coral reefs that are being destroyed because of the pathways and the things they've been setting up for the ships. But protesters have been protesting at Jeju Island in many ways. And this was dubbed the Island of Peace by late President No, and it was also the site in 1948 of a massacre in which more than 30,000 civilians were killed during a democratic uprising there. And it is, of course, strategically related to China. But the Jeju Island protests have been extensive. Our national campaign to end the Korean War sent some banners in solidarity there. We've tried to follow what's going on there and support the people there, but that base is getting built. And believe me, it isn't built for the size of the South Korean Navy. But what always makes me crazy is we get so close to peace and something happens. When I've met with the Foreign Relations Committee in Congress or the State Department, it always seems to be on the heels of a incident where they assured me Secretary Kerry was ready to go to Pyongyang and start direct talks, but why did they have to do that nuclear test? Or this was about to happen, or what, you know, someone was detained, and on the other side, something happens in the U.S. that has an impact that makes it just not the right time. And so there is a huge statue on what's called Reunification Highway in North Korea, where it carries and teaches the will and wish of the Korean people. And it carries their will to be one. But this is not just the will of the North Koreans. And the South Koreans in Seoul have that as a goal that we express for the eventual reunification. And Kim Il-sung, the leader, the founding leader in North Korea, the grandfather of Kim Jong-un, also said in proclamations that the ultimate goal is peace and reunification. And when did it start all of a sudden to thaw? The year was 2000, June 15th. Kim Jong-un meets with Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea. And in fact, that the president got a Nobel Peace Prize for those efforts. He went to North Korea. They entered a joint declaration at this time in 2000 about the people yearn for reunification. And they came up with a common element, is a co-federation and the North's formula that has a loose form of federation. So you got both sides wanting to share, you know, coast guards and sports teams and other things. And these were being talked about. Sydney in 2000, if you remember, the North and South Koreans march into the Sydney Stadium under one flag. And suddenly you start to think peace is happening. I mean, of course, all of us thought, wow, new millennium, you know, peace is at hand. You know, this is pre-September 11th, of course. And in that sense, there's hope. But here they march into the stadium. Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, goes to North Korea, meets Kim Jong-il, and also writes later in his book, he's not crazy. It wasn't crazy in the way that there was representation about that. But what happens? Bill Clinton is set to go to North Korea to negotiate or to seal the deal. And what happens? Some hanging chads in Florida. He was set to go around December of 2000, and we have an election that is in doubt. We have an election that leaves the country in a state where its president shouldn't leave at that point. And so what do we get? As a result, thank you to the United States Supreme Court, or no thanks, you got President George W. Bush coming into power, going before Congress at his State of the Union, and what does he declare? North Korea, Iraq, and Iran are an access of evil. Access of evil. Well, again, and it doesn't hurt that later he called Kim Jong-il a pygmy dictator and other names. I mean, we kind of forget, because we're in so much turmoil and distraction right now, that we didn't have it so good with the Rumsfeld-Cheneys, Wolfowitzes, and the boys who came in with the Bush administration. But this evil notion is one that we as peace builders need to get rid of. Solzhenitsyn said, if it were only so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, he said. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? So around 2005, I'm in North Korea a couple times, and I'm in South Korea. When I'm in South Korea, there's a golf course in North Korea. And I mean, maybe you've heard that Kim Jong-il got 6 holes in 1 in a row or something. I'm not sure what that rumor is, but they do like golfing in North Korea. But you know where they like golfing a lot, right? South Korea. The South Korea women golfers are like the best female golfers in the world. And when I'm in South Korea, I look in the newspaper, and what do I discover? I discover that women PGA golfers from South Korea are going to North Korea to play a golf tournament, the Pyongyang Open. This is 2005. This is at the height of the access of evil. You don't read about this in the New York Times, but there were these exchanges taking place because under President Ngo at the time and under the prior administration, they were building relationships. But our press was silent. And in fact, in 2007, President Ngo stepped over the line and went again to North Korea. And there, they came up with an even more extensive agreement about building a permanent peace regiment, economic opportunity, technology, culture, and arts. Let's do a joint cheering squad for the Beijing Olympics, promote video messages, deal with emergencies together, reduce military tension. These agreements are taking place while in the United States, it's access of evil and militarism and what the U.S. is doing there. So this back and forth has happened, but today we have a new opportunity in Korea because President Moon Jae-in is a progressive lawyer from the Minbyun legal group, progressive lawyers group in South Korea. And he came in with a different attitude. He came in and was elected and has exposed the corruption in prior elections, because after President No was out, they got a conservative leader in. And now they've been able to show the kinds of election tampering kinds of things that went on again in South Korea subsequent to when President Park, the recently impeached president, was elected. But there's a little opening and a ray of sunshine returning. He welcomed a group of North Korean athletes to South Korea for some international games. And he's been forced into a difficult situation by the current administration and by the nuclear tests. And he talked about South Korea does not need to be allowed by the U.S. to talk and dialogue with North Korea. Although the United States and South Korea have never finalized the negotiation of who makes final wartime decisions in South Korea. Currently, that resides not with the people of South Korea, but with the United States government. So they direct South Korean troops if a war breaks out, and the U.S. has ability to go it alone, if that's a phrase you've heard in the past. It's a haunting one. So why? Why? What are the motivations for maintaining this instability in this region? Well, I contend to you that they are economic, they are racial, and there are geopolitical factors at work. And the first one, if there's any surprise, is greenbacks, dollars. It's no surprise to any of us who do peace-building work that when you follow the money, you begin to understand some of the motivations involved, right? Well, what do we know? One thing we know is that South Korea has been by far one of the single largest customers of U.S. arms. President Trump has offered them more, allowing them to buy more weaponry. They have ranked as the highest in buying conventional arms of any country in the world. Now think about this. If there is peace and a co-federation and reunification, or at least a federation in North Korea, South Korea, and China and Japan in the region, so you get along okay from a military standpoint, what is South Korea's other threat at that point that they're buying these weapons for? Other interests are involved. It's become a tourist attraction. You're in a South Korean hotel room, and what do you get? Visits to the most dangerous place on the planet, tours, go on the monorail enhanced DMZ tour. This is a little crazy. This is in the Seoul. You can go to the Seoul War Museum and go to the DMZ cafeteria. I mean, it has become an entrenched story. I was speaking to a group of college students in South Korea at a university, and it was right after a nuclear test in North Korea. And I said, okay, you know, and I leaned into them and I said, are you a little nervous? How do you feel like about this? Everyone in that classroom, there was a few laughs, nervous laughs, just laughs, a couple little smiles, and they said, oh no, it's just that crazy uncle to the north. And there wasn't that kind of fear there. They've not been drilled. Now, they've been raised on drawing horns on North Koreans as kids, and you know, there's been demonization. But basically, they're into their cell phones and technology and their world, and they don't spend as much time on that angst. And I'm not taking away from the activists and other people who help things change.
You're listening to Eric Sorotkin on War or Peace in Korea. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In North Korea, how the war is dealt with is different and more extreme. In North Korea, It is government policy to teach about the atrocities of the Korean War. And you can get taken to the Victorious Fatherland Liberation War Museum, where there's a ground floor, a first floor, underground, a planet, there's a second floor, and they have planes of the U.S. that they shot down. They have evidence that they say of biological and chemical weapons used by the U.S. experimentally during the war that they recovered. They have incredible, painful stories of the war. And the school children go through the museum, and the soldiers go through the museum, and they go to underground places where of great atrocity, and they're told the story over and re-traumatized over and over again. And this is the environment that we see happening there. I visited Sincheon in North Korea. Sincheon is a place of where some of the war atrocities occurred. And you could see that in Sincheon, when you're there, you see mounds and things related to mass graves. We went down into an air raid shelter whose side of the walls were blackened with dried, like flesh almost. It was where a group of women and children were huddled during the war, and where it's alleged that South Korean soldiers, or they'll say U.S. soldiers, poured gasoline and dynamite down the air shafts of the vents and incinerated everyone. And you go into these places and your stomach turns. They're filled with great shame. I was able to return to Sincheon and speak to about 1,000 people gathered there about peace and talk about that old story of the grandfather who is talking to his grandson, and the grandfather says that there are two wolves inside of us, and the two wolves are fighting and angry at each other, and there's a battle going on in each of us. And the young child looks up at the grandfather with these big eyes and says, "Grandpa, who will win?" And the grandfather said, well, the grandfather tells him one is angry and hostile, and the other wolf inside is seeking peace and harmony and cooperative, and they're fighting. And he says, "Who will win?" And the grandfather says, "Whichever one I feed." And so I was able to tell some of these stories and tell the people at Sincheon that there are millions of peace-loving Americans who want peace with your country. And taking those steps as peace builders, always feel like we're making a difference, at least on a personal level. So how does race figure in? It's a very important element when you look to Asia and you compare our dealing with Europe and Asia and other places. We've always had a racial issue because we've always devalued Asian lives and not treated them in the same vein that we do loss of Anglo lives, at least. The Japanese internment camps, we know those stories. We know Hiroshima and Nagasaki and our ability to drop a bomb to incinerate so many people. We know the harsh stories of Vietnam and the carpet bombing and the napalm and the killing that took place in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. And in Korea, many things were beginning to come out. The Bridge at Nogunri is a great book, A Hidden Nightmare from the Korean War, Charles Hanley, an AP reporter. It won a Pulitzer Prize. And what they did is that the colonel, U.S. colonel, was given the order to strafe all civilian refugee parties approaching their position, and we've complied with their requests. Planes would come down, and they would gun down and kill refugees. And that was the order, because the order was these refugees are infiltrated by troops, we believe. And as a result, President Clinton had to issue an almost apology for what happened at Nogunri. But in the 90s, that helped soften things. I have found in my experiences in South Africa that they had a very important theme there, which was forgive, but not forget. And I think that's a real key when we look at these issues. There's also political obstacles, of course. The big one that we know nearby is China. North Korea borders China. And I'd say China does not want U.S. troops and weapons and other systems on its border. That's the reason so many Chinese troops came to the defense of North Korea as well. And you think about how if we had this peaceful Japan, South Korea, North Korea, China, this is why I got excited about working on these issues. I said that could be an example that could create a new way of a region to operate in our world. And so this is, I think, very possible, and I hope that that is something we'll be working toward here. I mentioned earlier one of the obstacles politically was the South Korea's national security law that I hope under this new president gets repealed finally. Because in South Korea, for decades, academics went to prison for teaching any story of history that could be construed as consistent with North Korea, that it wasn't a war of aggression. If you, as an academic in South Korea, treat the Korean War as a civil war and not a war of aggression by the North, you are violating the National Security Act, and you face up to 7 years in prison. You cannot meet. I've been at conferences, peace conferences, international ones, on peace and reunification in Korea, and the North Koreans are there. The South Koreans are not. And I ask why, and they say they can't come to this meeting. If they're at a meeting without the government's permission, they can go to prison. And this is something, in fact, the president who made all those leaps and bounds in 2000, himself prior to that, was sentenced to death for talking about these issues under the national security law. And then later that was commuted, and he got out of prison, and he went on to be the president of the country. He went on to cross the border, and he went on to meet with leaders of North Korea. But the UN has said this national security law is a major obstacle to South Korea's full realization of rights under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So what are the legal and political arguments for peace? Well, one is a basic human right to peace. I think we in the peace movement have allowed sometimes the right wing to co-opt the term human rights. They co-opt it to say, oh, North Korea violates human rights. And we've not used enough the idea that there is a human right to peace. And what do we know here? We know that there are documents to draw upon other than just international law. Why? Because the United States Constitution said all treaties become the supreme law of the land, and every judge in the United States must follow it. So treaties, international treaties that are ratified by the Senate, become binding on the United States. That's a constitutional right, and we always have to be holding it up. It's not international law we're talking about. It's U.S. domestic law. It's our Constitution. And in fact, the U.S. Senate ratified the United Nations Charter in 1945 by a vote of 89-2. Talk about partisanship in those days. But let's be telling these stories, because the UN Charter is an amazing document, and it gives obligations that need to be enforced. All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means. They will refrain from international relations from the threat or use of force. Right now, Donald Trump's statements of fire and fury, etc., of destroying a country, not only a war crime to carpet bomb and kill a country, but the threat is in the UN Charter illegal. That means it's illegal under the United States Constitution, because this is a treaty ratified and is the supreme law of the land. So use the UN Charter. Get to know that. I think it's a great tool. And talk about it not as the United Nations. Talk about it as the U.S. Senate. There is a right to peace that was passed in 1984. I think part because the Cold War was going on, but it's the right of people to peace. And the right to peoples to peace in Resolution 3911 says that it's the obligation of the state, yes, but we're the holders of the right to peace. You know, you're messing with us when you engage in this behavior. For the policies of a state must be for the elimination of the threat of war. And we have to adopt appropriate measures at both the national and international level. And the U.S. backed that. And who was president in 1984? Ronald Reagan, the god of the Republicans. And so consequently, these kinds of things can be used in dialogue. You hear a lot the history of prior agreements and their breaches. What do you hear? Can't trust the North Koreans. They've breached the agreements all the time. And guess what? They have broken some agreements. But if you look at the chronology, most of those agreements come after a breach by the United States. And I can say that as a lawyer for a few different ways. How do we know? We signed an armistice on July 27, 1953, that said that within 3 months after the armistice agreement is signed and becomes effective, a political conference will be held to settle by negotiations the withdrawal of all foreign forces and the peaceful settlement of the Korean question. The Soviets left in 1952. The Chinese left in some years later, and the U.S. has never left. It talked about the peaceful settlement. It shall be held. There was one meeting that was held, and they didn't even get very far in. It was at the height of the Cold War. Nothing came of that, and it went away. And I contend that we stand in breach of the armistice agreement in that vein. The armistice agreement said, neither side will introduce new weapons into Korea other than piece-by-piece replacement. Huh, that's interesting. And why did they do that? This is post-Hiroshima, Nagasaki. You know, they didn't want to be caught up in making this a nuclear playground. So what happened in connection with that? In 1956, they now said the intent of the U.S. military was to introduce atomic weapons into Korea. National Security Council and President Eisenhower went on. And through the 1970s, the U.S. had over 680 nuclear weapons in that country the size of Indiana. The U.S. brought nuclearization to the Korean Peninsula. In 1991, talking to South Koreans, they announced they'd ordered the withdrawal of the nuclear weapons. But air-delivered nuclear weapons were excluded from that plan, and they didn't set a timetable for their removal. Consequently, supposedly there are no nuclear weapons, but we have that capacity in our ships and otherwise around. The agreed framework, I don't know how many have heard about this under Bill Clinton, 1994, we're on the brink of war, and Clinton's not doing anything about it, and it's getting worse. And a former president of the United States said, this is crazy. And Jimmy Carter goes to North Korea, and he meets with Kim Il-sung, and they go on a boat trip for a couple days down a river in North Korea, you know, mano a mano. They talk about this, and he comes out of that trip with the promise and under the agreed framework. We'll give you nuclear reactors that are light water reactors. We'll help with power. We'll do this with fuel, etc., and Clinton kind of begrudgingly agrees. And some Clinton officials have said since they thought they'd never have to build these because what happened is 2 months after that, Kim Il-sung died, and they thought the regime would collapse. And so they didn't really follow through on the reactors much. They never set up a liaison office or negotiated a peace deal. So the real issue is how do we achieve nonproliferation? And let's talk about solutions. North Koreans said, even as recently as July 4th, Kim Jong-un said they would not put their nukes on the table of negotiations And the Washington Post left this line out. It's kind of interesting. Unless the U.S. postal policy and nuclear threat to the DPRK are definitely terminated. They told me many times when I was there, why would we put our gun down under these circumstances? So how do we move closer to this? Some people like Jimmy Carter are making great statements about the importance of a peace treaty. A former ambassador, James Laney, in South Korea, talked about the establishment of a peace treaty needs to be a baseline for a relationship. Because essentially, without a peace treaty and formal relations, you don't even show that the other side has a right to exist. And so, what is the roadmap to peace in Korea? I have a 12-step model. It's 12-step because we're kind of addicted to this conflict, so it's a little tongue-in-cheek. What are these 12 steps? First, listen deeply. Dialogue process and deep listening. Step two is focusing on what unites us, the common ground, the shared concerns. I could tell you the North Koreans are concerned about their children. They're concerned about eating and adequate food crops. When we divided Korea, it was no surprise that like 80%+ of the arable land was in the south. It's a very mountainous country in the north. They can't feed themselves. But find the things that provide common ground, music, culture, different things, and exchange, build harmony that way. Exchange art, sports, and culture. Respecting the other side is step four. Establish formal diplomatic relations. You don't have to agree with them. We have formal diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia, and they chop off people's heads in public, sometimes for sodomy and other crimes. Although I did hear that women are going to be allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, and we do sell them billions of dollars of fighter weapons and other things. So it certainly isn't about human rights that lead us to not have formal diplomatic relations. Over 160 countries have formal diplomatic relations with North Korea. I've met people in North Korea, Scottish farmers doing things there, Canadian teachers teaching there. These are not socialist countries or something. Step five is practicing non-resistance. We can transcend hostility when we engage in non-resistance in various ways. Step six is I call grow up. This is really, I wrote this well before the Donald Trump era. Because all these principles in that roadmap to peace, I presented to North Korea at a conference and to the president of the National Assembly there. I came back, I presented it at the State Department and at Congress. Grow up, release the enemy images and demonization, move beyond good and evil, if you will. Step seven, moving from reaction to relationship. I'm a mediator as well as a lawyer. And I've learned these principles not only through South Africa, but through mediations and mediation training. You can't work and bring people together from a point of reaction. Step eight, change to a language of peace. How we word things is important, and we're learning that more and more. Sadly, every single day. Step nine, forgiving the past and moving forward. And I've worked in North Korea with people I've known there on that to say, look, yes, terrible things. I condemn what happened to the end. We must honor the people who died on both sides, but that you don't have to just sweep it under a rug, but you can move forward, and there are ways to do that. Step number 10 is about redefining the story, reaching for a higher level in international relations. Isn't it time that we're not just putting our fingers in the dam? Isn't it time that we're not just trying to prevent against the next thing happening? We need to create the new models for the 21st century on international relations. And these involve these types of mediation principles. We should be calling on our best conflict resolvers. I've worked with the Navajo Peacemaker Courts. There's people there who have a look at the universe that can help us in these times, but so can our mediators, our people working in jails and prisons and dispute resolution all over. The next step is develop a conversion strategy for any conflict. Here, it's about bringing the troops home and converting the demilitarized zone. Even Ted Turner some years ago had this great plan for turning the demilitarized zone into a peace park. And there are these proposals that have been out there. Can we somehow convert that ends up being that everyone, the North gets praised, the South gets praised, the UN, the US, everyone wins. When you create an example for the world. And finally, step 12 is what I call letting go of the rope. If you know a tug of war and you're pulling and the other side is pulling, this is what we see. If you let go of the rope in a tug of war, what happens? The tug of war ends, no matter what. The other people can yell, pick up the rope, pick up the rope. But when do we learn that picking up the rope is not the answer? Something else is the answer, and it's tied into these elements of non-resistance. So if we bring these principles to a coalition and try to, through the Lawyers for a Democratic Society, that's what President Moon was involved with in South Korea. There's some wonderful peace groups working in South Korea as well. But here in the US, we can find alliances and support with a variety of US groups. And really, I have a group called Lawyers for Demilitarization and Peace in Korea. If you know some lawyers who want to get involved in that, you don't even have to be a lawyer. Anyone who wants to help with that, glad to have help. But I think we need to provide the talking points and the material forward to people, because people don't know how to talk about this issue. To Washington, I've taken them to the meetings in the Foreign Relations Committee. We've had some Congress people step forward. This at the time is Dennis Kucinich at an event where we're here in Washington with a great statement against on the 60th anniversary of the war. And we currently have 12 or 13 US senators who just signed a letter. You should get your senator on board. A letter to the president about no war, we want a peace treaty with Korea. And it's Senator Udall in New Mexico, Senator Merkley in Oregon, Warren, Sanders, quite a few others. But that's the biggest movement. We've never had much support in the Senate. I've sat with Tom Udall in his office and tried to lay these out. And he's on the Foreign Relations Committee and got no headway. And now we're getting movement. In the House, Barbara Lee, John Conyers, who's a Korean War vet, they're beginning, and they have something going in the House. We met with the State Department, as I mentioned. I met with the National Security Council folks during President Ngo's time in South Korea, because it's important that they know things are going on. And what's important are these exchanges, going to North Korea, meeting with people there, shaking hands, and telling them. I've told President Kim Jong-nam of the Supreme People's Assembly, the president of that there are millions of peace-loving Americans who want a resolution. And you just see faces relax. You see people who could be potentially hostile calm down to know that there may be hope. So what are the talking points? Talk about peace treaties. Talk about formalized relations. Talk about supporting the sunshine policy of the new president of South Korea, supporting the self-determination of the Korean people. Talk about non-proliferation, but talk about that it requires the immediate suspension of the annual war games, and it requires unconditional negotiations more than putting, oh no, first drop your gun, and work toward a withdrawal of troops. Bring them home. And so when governments can't find the peace, I think people must take the action. So I call upon you all, write your congressional people with the talking points, call the Secretary of State, write the president, and just get on the line and go to whitehouse.gov, write letters to your editor on these things, support groups like ours, Lawyers for Disarmament and Peace, contact the South Korean embassy, tell them you support their president's sunshine policies. And finally, hold forums like this all over, because we can stand together for peace. if we have the will and if we have the information. So thank you.
That was Eric Sorotkin on War or Peace in Korea. He spoke at the University of Colorado. Eric Sorotkin is a human rights lawyer. His peacemaking activities have taken him to North and South Korea. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michael Parenti, Angela Davis, Chris Hedges, Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Eric Sorotkin on War or Peace in Korea, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Tim Butler recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.